Welcome to Start Writing. I'm Joe Bendosky.
And I'm Jay Washburn.
And we are finishing up our series on plot this month. Today we're going to be focusing on the author's promise and climax. As I've gone through the notes, there's going to be bits and pieces of this that we have covered before. So just be aware of that as we go in. And then there's a few addendums I wanted to kind of make, things that I've kind of come across since we've talked about this. In our discussion on Crisis, one of the things we talked about was the Deus Ex Machina, right? The God in the machine coming to bail out your heroes. And one of the specific examples we discussed was Brandon Mull's Fable Haven, how the fairies come in and they just fix everything. And I actually heard Brandon Sanderson speak on this ending specifically.
Wait, Sanderson speaking about Mull's ending?
Yeah, Mull's ending. Talking about it as Deus Ex Machina, but then he brought up this, and what he mentioned, he said, one of the things people want when they read is a sense of wonder. And that is often found in fantasy as we explore magic and incredible worlds. And Mull was trying to give that sense of wonder to the reader. And while being aware that it was a Deus Ex Machina, the point of the book was to give fantasy readers a sense of wonder. And there hadn't been a strong sense of wonder in the book yet. Mm. And so he took advantage of putting that at the end. Because while there is a Deus Ex Machina moment there, what the reader really wants out of a fantasy is a sense of wonder, and he hadn't delivered that yet, so he put it there.
I feel like I'm sort of a story architect rather than like a pantser, just figuring out as I go, but I would look at that ending and say, okay, we got the wonder right, now let's put it in the right place. And I think it could be possibly more fulfilling for the story if it were, say, near the midpoint.
I agree. I just read it like a couple months ago. It's like the last Mistborn novel that he just wrote. It's with Wax and Wayne.
Yeah, I don't know.
Bands of Mourning. That's what it is. Bands of Mourning. And in it, there is an incredible sense of wonder, and it is right before the crisis in the book. And it is, you know, it's like you said, it doesn't come at the very end in the Deus Ex Machina moment. It's there. And so I think that worked really well in the book.
I'll have to read it. But no, I can agree with Sanderson that that's definitely something I look for as a reader. I love to be awed.
Yes.
To feel marvel at, you know, the world or whatever.
Yeah, so what's happening
definitely
there.
Something I enjoy, but if you shift its position, then it doesn't have to steal the thunder.
Exactly. And I agree with that. Like, I mean, when I read Fable Haven, I didn't love it. Like my friend Ben, he read like the entire series over a weekend. He enjoyed it so much.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, and it took me about two weeks to read the Fable Haven. It's fairly short just because I just wasn't in love with it from the beginning. I mean, if you've read Fable Haven, you've met Seth, and Seth is insanely frustrating. And Mull wants him to be that way. You know, I've heard Mull talk about Seth, and he says, if I talk to anyone about Seth, they get so frustrated. It says, I talk to a 10-year-old boy, and then they agree with everything he does.
That's awesome.
And we also talked about the end being a failure, the hero failing, but the ending is good. And an example I thought of after we'd finished recording was Rocky. In the first Rocky movie, he doesn't beat Apollo. He loses that fight. But there is a moment in the story where Rocky tells Adrian.
Yeah.
He tells Adrian. How could you forget that? He tells Adrian that he wants to go to distance. The most Rocky hopes for in this fight against Apollo is just not to lose by knockout. So even though he doesn't win the fight, it is still a victory in its own way, because that is the most Rocky thought that he could hope for going in, was to just be able to survive all the rounds against Apollo. So it's not the big victory, but the ending is still good. So anyway, now we're on to the author's promise. This actually, I know, I've been watching a ton of lectures by Brandon Sanderson recently, so there's a lot coming from him just because he's kind of been my focus of study recently. But he tells a story of himself and an author you have never heard of. Now, if you never heard of Brandon Sanderson, he's a multiple time best-selling author for the New York Times bestseller list. The Mistborn trilogy is listed in one of the top 100 fantasies ever written. You know, I mean, he is a big-time fantasy author. He tells a story of when he was just starting his career. He had just written his first published book, Elantris. His books were starting to do fairly well, and his career, you know, then he'd written a few more, was starting to take off, and there was another author who had just started publishing fantasy at about the same time, and his career never really went anywhere, and even his first novel was kind of a flop. So Brandon picked it up, and he read it, because he was curious to try and understand why had he done so well, and why had this other guy not, and, you know, the prose were good, you know, the writing, you know, was well done, but the interesting thing is that in Brandon's books, you are entering a new world, and you know that from the beginning. It's not a traditional fantasy. There's not elves and dwarves, you know. In each of his world, things are very different and unique. If we look at the Mistborn, you've got the Ska, you've got nobility, the Kolos, and I can't remember what Sazed's tribe is, but they've got their own kind of magic abilities. There are no elves, there's no dwarves, there's no wizards, you know. And so you know going in, you're in a very different fantasy world. And this other writer had written a very traditional fantasy, right? Very stock and traditional. A lot of, you know, there was a big explosion in the 80s of all the elves and dwarves fantasy writing. About 75% of the way through this guy's book, he completely upends everything. And it's suddenly
Did he say what the...
He didn't go into the specifics, but it was no longer following the traditional fantasy story and the traditional fantasy world. It's like everything was upended. And, you know, it was supposed to be this big element of irony and even kind of, you know, a tongue-in-cheek comment on the way traditional fantasy was functioning at the time. The problem was that happened 75% of the way in the book. And so what we're looking at today is in your first chapter and in your first act, you make a promise to your readers. It's a promise about how you're going to tell a story, and it's a promise about the type of story you're going to tell. And Brandon made it clear up front he wasn't telling a traditional fantasy from chapter one of his books. You know, I am not basically in Middle Earth with a different author, right? You know that's not where you are with a Sanderson book. Whereas, you know, with Terry, Terry Brooks, I think, you know, his world is different than Middle Earth, but it's still very traditional fantasy.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you've got elves, you've got dwarves and trolls and gnomes. You know, he has a different skew. You know, there's these ancient weapons that are machine guns and stuff that occasionally people have from the old world. But it's very rare. For the most part, it's very traditional fantasy. You know, swords and magic and stuff like that. And you know that going in, and he stays with that through his story. Because in the first chapter, in the first act, you're reading a traditional fantasy. And if you've committed that far, it's because you want to read a traditional fantasy. And if you pick up a Sanderson, you know you're not reading a traditional fantasy. You get this awe of seeing a new magic system at play, and you get to see this new world. And then they fulfill that promise. I'm going to, Sanderson shows you how this new world works, and it's fascinating. And Terry fulfills the kind of story you expect in a traditional fantasy. But this author that started his career at the same time as Brandon Sanderson, 3/4 of the way through the book, he said, I am not telling you that kind of story. He says, but that late in the book, if people have read that far, they want that kind of story. Hmm. One of the great examples of this is Dan Wells wrote a book called I'm Not a Serial Killer. He is a fantastic writer. This first book of his I ever read. Great writer. And like gripped me from the very first page. And then if you ask anyone who's read this book if there's anything that bothered them, they will all tell you the exact same thing, the demon. And the reason that bothers so many people is because he comes in after Act 1.
I guess it's too late for this, but the movie, they're about to...
They're making a movie.
To come out, so we should insert a spoiler alert if we can.
We should have...
But actually, it's funny. You watch the trailer, or at least one of the early trailers, and it also does not hint at anything supernatural. But
And what happens in this book is Act One is about a kid who has a lot of predictors of becoming a serial killer, and he's fascinated with serial killers. And so you're in his mind as he's dealing with the challenges of adolescence, bullies and girls, and just connecting with family members. And it's a fascinating story, right? Like, you're there in his therapy sessions with his therapist, and you know how he's trying to be normal without very normal functioning brain. And it's really interesting, right? And that's the story I wanted to read, about a kid dealing with the challenges of adolescence who is a sociopath. It was fascinating. And then all of a sudden a demon walks in. And I'm like, what am I reading now? Right? The author's promise was a bait and switch.
Yeah. So when I reached that point in the novel, I actually felt somewhat relieved, because the first was just so heavy and realistic.
Mm.
And I mean, I loved it. It's a heavy... No, it's not that I didn't like it, but it was just to... insert the supernatural allowed me to just kind of relax and enjoy it more as a story and not have quite as much empathy for like this realistic, real world, actual kid. But the switch was jarring too.
It is.
I felt like I switched books.
It does.
I read one book and now I'm reading this other book.
Yeah, it does. It does. And it bothered a lot of people. A lot of people who read the book are very bothered, and a lot of people stop reading, you know, because Kindle Unlimited has that statistic, and they'll tell you, a lot of people stop reading here when the demon shows up.
Okay, so let's pretend this is your novel, this is your eighth draft, and someone tells you this, that this is a problem. What are you going to do to Act One to change that? How are you going to hint at the demon, or
I think
what are you going
to? I think you need. You need to be hinting at the supernatural in the first act, right?
So maybe the hero has glimpses of it, or suspects it, or he's reading an old book. Like, how would you actually go about?
How would I actually go about it? Because I actually heard Sanderson talking about his critique groups with Dan Wells, and everyone mentioned this to him, and so he tried to go back and insert a few things.
So maybe they're like really subtle.
But I think they're too subtle, because a lot of people are still having problems with the book at this point. I mean, the book does sell well. It is very well written. But it's a tough point for people to get over. He mentions at one point in the book that this was before people knew about demons. And so I think maybe he needs to go back at the beginning of the book and maybe have, you know, a newscast. Something needs to present this idea to a larger world. Even if that larger world rejects it, it puts that idea in the mind of the readers.
Yeah.
So that we're like, that's a possibility, you know? Because it really just feels like it comes out of nowhere when it happens. And it was super frustrating for me. I didn't read the book for 2 days. I was like, I don't know if I'm going back. You ruined the story, Dan. Why'd you do that?
But no, it turns out it's still a fun story. But yeah, that transition is jarring.
It is. It is. And I mean, even as I continued to read the book, the parts that fascinated me were the parts I appreciated in Act One. Because he still has to negotiate his family relationships. And there's a girl he likes, and you know, and those are still the parts I enjoyed later in the book. You know, the demon, it was like, yeah, okay, you know, but you know, the promise in that first chapter is what I wanted fulfilled, and then in Act Two, that wasn't the story he was telling anymore.
Yeah.
So the promise is a big deal, because there are hooks, and you know, when we try to have conflict and everything, but the bottom line is, In that first chapter and in that first act, you tell your audience, this is the kind of story I'm telling. And then they make a decision if that's the kind of story they want to read.
Well, and you're setting up that promise with your title and with the cover art.
Title, cover art,
how it gets tagged as far as genre goes. There's a lot of expectations that you create, and you gotta.
But the first chapter really should do all that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the first chapter needs to tell, you know, because your voice is gonna come out, and we'll cover voice next month. That's our next topic. But for me, like, even in my own book, when we're talking about mass hysteria, a lot of people were saying, well, you could just cut it off right here at the end of the mass hysteria. I was like, no, I need to tell people that it was a hoax, because my story isn't a, it reads like a supernatural sci-fi fiction if I cut it off before people find out it was caused by a hoax. Right, because that's what the story is about, is the fact that it's a hoax and looking into that psychology and how that's possible.
Cool. So this expectation thing, by the way, all it connects to what we discussed about Deus Ex Machina. I think I said this before, but it's okay to have a god swoop down and save the protagonist. If, in chapter one, you talk about, okay, there are gods in this world. And if you pray the right way or do the right things, you can actually get the gods to come down and save you. And if you manage those expectations, then you can still you're not limited in what you can do. You just got to set it up right.
Oh, this I feel like I talked about Sanderson way too much, but I just finished whatchamacallit. What was the book? I just read it. Warbreaker. I just finished Warbreaker. Yeah. And there is a guy who is the God King, but there is a limitation on his power, right? And there's a bunch of what they call gods. Like there's a debate as to whether or not they're gods or not, depending on which religion people are in. And the gods have the ability to heal someone, right? They can give up their life and perform an incredible miracle for someone. And people are constantly petitioning for them. And there's a character named Lightsong. And he, in the opening, he's just like, I don't know why I would ever give up my life, to do one of these miracles for these people. I can't see that ever happening. Well, what limits the God King's power is that in order to enact a lot of his powers, he has to be able to speak. And when he was a child, they cut out his tongue. And so that because he had so much power, they didn't want him to be able to use it. They figured it just made him too powerful. And so at the end of the book, Light Song performs a miracle and he heals the God King, and then suddenly there's this insanely powerful God going out and doing all this stuff. But it works because that's been a big plot throughout the whole story, right? It's not Deus Ex Machina. It's something we have been working towards and discussing the entire time.
Yeah, cool. That's awesome. That's a perfect example.
Yeah, perfect example. Yeah, it was a perfect example. Sorry, there are spoilers galore here, guys. We should have warned you.
Well, just put it in the description. Right? Spoilers for this book.
Yeah. And so with this author's promise, you're gonna, as you set up questions in the reader's minds about different things going on in the book, you need to start fulfilling some of these questions and promises in Act 2, some of the smaller ones. And the reason for that is that when you start to fulfill on promises, readers begin to see how you will fulfill a promise. One, they see that you're going to, not you're just going to dump them off a cliff and leave things undone, because that happens. So by starting to fulfill promises in Act 2, readers see that you will fulfill promises, that you're keeping track of your threads and you're tying some off. And two, they see how you do it. Do you answer questions and fulfill promises in a satisfying way? And so it's kind of important to address that in Act 2. And a big way you'll do this is your set pieces, as we've talked about that. Now, we've mentioned in shorter books, there's just not room for that. But in most books, there's room for a couple set pieces throughout it. Let me think. Oh, there was a book that I helped work on a while back called The Green Thing in the Mirror. And it's the supernatural book about this green thing in the mirror that like steals people into the mirror.
Huh,
right.
Cool.
The whole book is about them investigating this event and trying to figure out and understand it. And at the end of the book, we don't find out what it is. I was like, wait, like I will not forget the moment when we all read the final chapter. Everyone was angry, be like, hang on, the whole book was about finding this out and we didn't. You backed out on your promise, right? That was the promise.
This is a book written by one of your peers?
Yeah.
In your writing group?
Purpose written in my writing group. I was like, that's what the book was about. You can't unfulfill that promise. That is why we read.
So do you think, obviously one solution to that is to explain the green thing in the mirror.
Right.
That's what you want. How is there, can you do the Rocky ending where it's like, okay.
So how do you approach that without, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, could you set up the expectations that there's something else that is the main thing, and it's not discovering right. what's in the mirror, but maybe it's, you know, a friendship or getting the girl back or...
So, well, I think we need to look at this problem a couple different ways, okay? Because if you're a plotter and you reach this point, it's an easy fix. You can go one of two ways. Either you change the ending so that you find out what the green thing in the mirror is, or you stagger it, like Mistborn by Sanderson. The big thing is actually that the world is broken by these two gods who have been warring against each other.
And you don't even touch it till the second book.
Right. You don't even realize that's what's going on until the second book. There are little hints throughout the first book, but unless you know what's coming, you can't recognize that they're there, right? And so it you know, as a plotter, you can structure it that way and be like, okay, I don't want to answer this question. So you change the whole promise so it's about a smaller question, one that you will answer in the first book, right? And so those are the two ways you can do that as a plotter. As a panster, you're dealing with a much more difficult problem, right? I guess it depends on how much rewriting you want to do. You can address the problem the same way as a panster if you're okay with a lot of rewriting.
Yeah.
But if not, I don't know. Like if you get to that end, you don't fulfill your promise, and you're not okay with a massive rewrite on your book at this point. I don't know. I think you just have to suck it up and fulfill your promise, yeah. right? Like, because there's only two options, a massive rewrite, or you just suck it up and be like, well, I promise, so I will deliver. Because if you don't, readers are going to be terribly upset and unsatisfied. And no matter how good your book was, this is the feeling they walk away with, you know, when all is said and done. Like, I think I mentioned last podcast or two podcasts ago about the book about Renata on the alien planet, and then, like, all of a sudden she just, like, descends into godhood and leaves everything undone. I was upset after reading that book, to the point I won't recommend it. If someone had asked me 60% through, be like, is it a good book? I'd be like, oh, yeah, check it out. It's great. You should read it. But after finishing it,
man.
I don't recommend the book, because my final feeling was dissatisfaction with how the story ended. The author's promise is so important in how people will walk away feeling about your story when all is said and done.
Man, and the ending is super important. I remember reading this interesting study that... so their two groups were... The first group had 2 minutes of like a level 6 pain, like some sort of electric shock for 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Or... Yeah, let's say it was 2 minutes. And then the second group had that same level of electric shock for 2 minutes, followed by an extra 20 seconds of decreased shock. So they had the exact same amount of shock as the first group,
mm-hmm.
plus a decrease at the ending. And that second group reported that the overall experience was much less.
Yeah, much less painful.
Because there's a bias toward the ending.
Yep.
And the same thing happens in your fiction, that so much rides on your ending. The feeling that you give them in those last few chapters is what they're mainly going to walk away with.
Right.
Even if the rest, 90% of your book is good and the last 10% you botch it, you ruined it.
You ruined it. Exactly. Exactly. So, all right. So we'll talk about climax itself specifically. I think we've kind of covered the author's promise fairly thoroughly at this point. One of the things we've talked about a lot is Game of Thrones, the set pieces. And I remember specifically Travis mentioned that a lot of times the climax doesn't feel like a climax because there's so many set pieces going on and there are no hot spots. So one of the things you want to look at in building that climax are hot spots, right? Where you take multiple subplots and you stack them all on each other in one grand moment. Now, there's three that are kind of stock and trade for having your climax. One is the major conflict between the protagonist and the antagonist. Like, that's what defines this is the climax, right? And then you usually will stack on a climax to the romantic storyline within it. And then you usually will have the hero's inner conflict. Usually those three are standards stacked on top of each other, all three, as a hot spot. You actually don't see that very often in Martin's books, right? So that's one of the reasons they don't look that way. But you can also stack in some other subplots. One of the great ones is Lord of the Rings. This is from the movies. In Return of the King, Frodo collapses as they're climbing Mount Doom, right? And Sam has this great line where he says, I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you. And he picks Frodo up, and he starts climbing the mountain with Frodo on his back. And this is the climax of Sam's storyline in that's taking place in the midst of the actual climax of the story, because Sam has just followed Frodo everywhere, and that's just what Sam does. But Sam in this moment is no longer following Frodo, he's carrying him, and so he becomes one of the heroes in his own right in this moment. He's not just along for the ride anymore. And so you have that subplot that climaxes along with all the other climaxes that are happening. The battle at Minas Tirith, you know, the destroying of the ring. All of that is going on. And you also have this subplot stacking into that hot spot as well.
Yeah, well, and so Gollum's plot line is resolved at that point.
Yeah, Gollum's subplot ends
Aragorn
there.
Aragorn leading the men into battle, essentially into their death. Which is what creates the open path for Frodo and Sam to go. Like, yeah, all these just line up and finish kind of at the same moment, mm-hmm. and you just have such a powerful
lot of hot spots stacking right there, yeah. Yeah, and so that's what makes a climax really powerful, is having all these events stacking together. So, but again, you do want to have some set pieces in those longer stories. Because, you know, it's kind of a way to pull that reader along. But a lot of hot spots is a good way to go for that strong climax. And there's a few other moments. The moment of truth is that internal conflict that we talked about, the hero. Now, this event tends to kind of happen all over the board. Sometimes it happens right before the crisis. Sometimes it happens right after the crisis. You know, sometimes it takes place in the midst of the big conflict. So if we look at Star Wars, our standard here, which we've really strayed from as we've talked about the author's promise, haven't we? Anyway, so like the moment of truth for Luke is when he decides to trust in the Force for his final shot on the Death Star, and that takes place during the climax itself. You've got Mail, which we talked about for set pieces in non-physical conflict stories. Joe Fox proposes a hypothetical situation that if he had not been Fox Books, then they could have lived happily ever after from when they first met. And he proposes this question and creates this moment of truth for her before she goes to meet this stranger who ends up being him, right? And so that's a moment of truth that happens before the climax takes place. And so, like I said, the moment of truth is not in a standard place. It kind of shifts all over a little bit, but it's always part of the climax.
By the way, depending on your story, you can have an internal conflict and an external conflict happen at the same moment. Like maybe stepping forward to fight is the moral victory, and then it also becomes a physical victory. Other stories, they're going to be forced to not happen exactly at the same moment, but they still happen approximately at the same time.
Well, and I mean, none of this can happen all at the same time. You still have to move through it sequentially, but it's, you know, you hit boom, hot spot. So yeah, another moment is the let's roll, or the final charge. So a lot of times, like if you're dealing with a cowardly hero, this is the moment when they decide they're not going to run, but then they charge in towards that final conflict, right? This is where Luke goes in for his final shot, you know, like he goes down with his team, and that's kind of him. They're charging into danger there. So, or you could also look at it as the let's roll moment as when he signs up to join the rebellion and they're going to go attack the Death Star. You could kind of look at it either way there. But it's a moment when the hero chooses to charge towards danger, you know. It shows them as being bold and courageous in doing these things, because that's kind of a standard and important trait for a hero. If, you know, if they don't have courage and boldness, they tend not to be the protagonist of a story.
Right.
So in Star Wars Episode 5, Yoda tells Luke that if he faces Luke Vader, he will fail, and if he goes to Star City, he will face Vader. And Luke says that he has to go anyway to save his friends. This is his let's roll moment, where he charges into danger for the sake of other people. So this is actually, I heard Brandon Mall talk on this, so I have to give him credit to this incredible idea. And this is about character connection to the climax. And the example he used is the movie Rudy. If you explain the climax of the movie Rudy to someone, it sounds terrible. It sounds terrible because this is the climax of the movie. Rudy gets in to play football for Notre Dame for a single play. It doesn't change the way the game ends. They don't win or lose based on how he performs. It's nothing major about the football game, about the season. If Rudy's on the team, it's irrelevant to how all of that plays down. But when Rudy goes on the field, everybody cheers, right? It's like, Rudy, Rudy finally made it. And the reason it is such an incredible moment is because of the character story that brings him there. Because in the story, you see how hard he has worked and how much he has sacrificed and how much he has wanted it and just giving everything he had to get that moment. And so when you see all that the character has gone through and everything they have done, this moment that looks so irrelevant from the outside is this incredible climax in an unforgettable story. Because it's about how that character is connected to that climactic moment. And it's such a great example, because if somebody told you this is the climax of my story, he's going to get on the field for one play, and that's it. You think, that is a terrible story, we're never going to tell that. And Rudy is a classic story that's incredible. You know, like, if you've ever played sports in high school, you watch Rudy. Because it's just that incredible story of his dedication and sacrifice, you know? And so I love this idea and pointing out how the closer you can connect a character's personal journey to that climax, the more powerful it becomes, because that is all of the power behind the climax of Rudy. You have this incredible climax of an incredible story, not because of what actually happens in the climax, right? The physical climax itself is actually a really dull moment, but because the character storyline is so strong, it makes it great. And so if you can take a great moment, like destroying a Death Star, and have a Rudy kind of character connection to it, just unbelievable. That's an nice. Unbelievable story.
So yeah. you used the term physical, and then you also said character. Right. I tend to think of it as like a physical victory and an emotional victory. And it's true that he doesn't have a physical victory. I mean, he walks on a field.
He walks on a field.
That's it. There really is no physical victory, but the emotional. Anyway, I'm just like framing it with different terms. But yeah, I think of it as like the emotional side.
Yeah. So, and one of the things to look at is the setting of the final conflict. And so this really falls into three categories. There is the only place that it can happen. So if we look at Star Wars, it has to happen on the Death Star. There's nowhere else you could have the climax of Star Wars. And then the other thing you can look at, depending on your story, is a fitting place. And so if you have a story about a child killer, the final conflict could happen on a playground. And so there's kind of this...
That's so creepy.
This tongue-in-cheek, you know, so thing creepy. It's a fitting place to have this final conflict based on how your story has gone down, right? And then the last is picking the most interesting place that you can have a final conflict. So if we look at Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, it takes place in the Canyon of the Crescent Moon, which is actually part of the city of Petra, which is this city built into a canyon wall. It's just fascinating and incredible to see, right? And I mean, the real conflict of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is Indiana Jones versus the Nazis. You could have done that final conflict just about anywhere, but they wanted to pick one of the most interesting places they could put it, and they picked a really good one.
Yeah, it's so
like
good.
When you see that temple built into the canyon wall, yeah. It's just fascinating. And so those are the three things you kind of want to look at the setting. You know, for some stories there is only one place it can happen, like Star Wars, but with a lot of stories it can happen in a lot of different places. And so you can then look at, do I want a fitting place like the playground for a child killer, or do I want an interesting place like the Canyon of the Crescent Moon?
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, just about kind of spicing that up a little bit. And then a lot of times in stories, we have the aftermath of the climax. And so this is, the villain is dead, but the roof is collapsing. So in Star Wars Episode 6, they kill the Emperor, but the Death Star is still blowing up, and Luke has to get out, and he's dragging Vader with him, right? So they still have to get out. They don't actually make it a big deal in Star Wars when this happens, but in some movies they do, like Toy Story, you have this huge climax where they are able to escape from Sid, who melts and destroys all these toys, but then they still miss the moving van and have to try and get on the moving van, otherwise they're left behind, right? And so it's kind of that, you know, but the bridge is falling or the roof is collapsing. And you'll see this a lot in movies, like Inception, right? They deliver the package finally at the very end, and then they have to try and get out in time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're going to be stuck in the dream for years.
Man, the ending of Toy Story is great. And to be honest, if I were to just look at that as a writer, I'd be like, well, it kind of seems like you have two really...
Two climaxes.
High climaxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for some reason, it just works.
So, well, and I think a lot of times what this essentially breaks down to is the fight and the a chase, right? Because, okay. And you, like I said, you see it a lot, you know, that you have the fight against Sid, and that is a direct physical conflict between a protagonist and an antagonist. And then the chase is just about survival.
Hmm. Yeah. In my book, Song of Locke, there's like five chapters in a row that are all somewhat climactic, and there's like the psychological villain, and then the resolution with the girl, and then the physical villain, and then there's kind of survival. Anyway, there are these really short chapters where it's just
chapters if there's that many of them.
Well, it's kind of the hot spots essentially.
Yeah, stacking the hot spots. Yeah. But you don't want to put all the hot spots at the end. So, Brandon Sanderson actually warns people against that. He said he used to do it all the time, and everybody hated it. So, and he's like, he is now famous for his set pieces, like George R. R. Martin. Like, anyone who reads Sanderson tells you it's the great set pieces that just keep pulling you forward.
That's cool.
So, and I guess a final comment here is you want to push the climax as far as you can without being ridiculous, right? So let's say your final conflict is a fist fight between the protagonist and the antagonist. We'll be like, well, let's up the stakes. Let's put it on top of a moving train. And then we'll put a bomb inside the train. And they did that in Mission Impossible, right? They just said, let's up the ante. Let's up the ante. And yeah. They even threw in a helicopter, right?
Oh,
we'll have a helicopter shooting at them. It'll be great.
Yeah, and I think it works pretty well.
So, yeah, like, and even as I read it, it sounds ridiculous. Like, we'll have a fist fight on top of a moving train with a bomb inside, and a helicopter shoots at them. It sounds ridiculous. But then you watch Mission Impossible, and it's awesome.
And that's like the least ridiculous of the whole series.
So, but yeah, so you want to push that as far as you can without crossing into the ridiculous.
That's a good point. Okay, one final question before closing. So we talked about setting up expectations. How do you still have some surprise? How do you still catch your reader off guard while safely setting up expectations?
Well, I think one of that is, one of the things there is the red herring, right? It's the great tool of this expectation that isn't just something you won't fulfill. It's leading them in the wrong direction, right? It's so that so you fulfill a promise and they realize, okay, that can't be done now, right? It shuts down the red herring, and in that moment, right? So you set up an expectation, but you have that surprise, and that's a big function of the red herring.
And I think whatever your surprise is in the ending, the reader should have this moment where they're like, oh, and they think back to the five or six things that you had throughout the story that now that they know the ending, they're like, oh yeah, now I get it. Those were pointing exactly to this.
Yeah.
And I just didn't see it. So you've got to do it subtly, but I think they have to make that connection or you're going to have some Deus Ex going on.
Yeah. So, all right. That's it for our episode. We'll have the show notes. The show notes are not like a full in-depth of the podcast. They're actually the notes we refer to from when we discuss, but if you just want a brief review or to look at something, They're there, and then you can see like the full novel descriptions and full authors if we cut anything short, just for quick reference on the website. I haven't put up any novel edits in a while. I've been reading far too many things all at once. But if you want to write in, make any suggestions or anything like that, it's please start writing at gmail.com. We are always looking for authors. In fact, I had a couple cancellations this month, so we don't actually have an interview for you this month because too many people canceled on me. We've recommended people check out ACX, Indie Authors, if you're not familiar with that. But I was actually curious if anyone has used it and what their experiences was with it, if they could write in. Because everyone I've talked to, the farthest they've gone is getting auditions. I haven't met anyone who's actually used it to the end point where it's published on Audible. Yeah, that's it. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and start writing.
There you go.